Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Lynn Povich, who began her career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975 she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. Since leaving Newsweek, she has been editor-in-chief of Working Woman magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lynn Povich.
Thank you, Ian.
So just before we begin, I'd like to, since you've obviously had a long career in journalism and to some extent the role of journalism has been questioned following the first presidential debate, in as much as a lot of people are piling on Jim Lehrer for not asking tough questions and not controlling the event. But in a sense, these debates, I don't think, serve the American people. There's only three of them. They're so orchestrated and so controlled. The big issues, for example, that everybody's been thinking about, at least in terms of Mitt Romney, have been his taxes and his statements about the 47%. Well, that simply didn't appear. So what would your critique be as a journalist of what happened last night?
Well, I do think that the general consensus that Obama didn't perform as well as he should have, he didn't raise all of the issues he has in the past and has all this information, and that Romney seemed to me to control and have most of the time on the debate. Now, what he said and whether it was true is certainly being questioned, and I think Obama tried to make that remark. But I think everyone says that being a moderator for one of those debates is a thankless job. I do think that Jim Lehrer certainly didn't control it and wasn't specific enough in his kinds of questions. And I think that's unfortunate.
So how did it strike you, though, that where a candidate running for president of the United States says to the moderator, essentially, I'm going to put you out of business. I'm going to defund PBS.
I was amazed that he said that, and I'm amazed that people haven't been talking about that ever since. I know they talk about performance, but I haven't seen that specifically raised. I think that's pretty shocking, and I think for those of us who care and are loyal listeners and supporters of any kind of public television or radio, you know, this certainly will define his position of how he feels about communities and serving communities.
So tell me then about, let's go back to your story in the new book, The Good Girl Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. You started out, and of course there are obvious comparisons to Mad Men in the sense that that seems to be the environment that out of which you began. But then, of course, the period that we're talking about also was the period of great change from the button-down Eisenhower years to the swinging 60s. So tell us about when you first got to Newsweek and how you as a woman and your colleagues were treated.
Well, we were the generation who were post-war generation who were raised in the 40s and 50s, and the expectation for most women then was that you might get a job and then you would get married and have children. The idea of a career never crossed my parents' lips, and I went to a women's college. No professor ever suggested that I prepare for a career. So actually, at the time, getting hired at Newsweek was a very glamorous job because it was a newsroom. It was fascinating. We worked with the writers and the reporters. The problem was that the structure of Newsweek, which simply copied the structure from Time, was that only men were hired as reporters and writers, and only women were hired as fact checkers or researchers. Actually, we started on the mail desk and then clipped newspapers. And then if we could do that, we got to be researchers. So while the system was collegial and fun and exciting, it was patriarchal. It was definitely run by the guys. And we were a class of women who could not get promoted out of this category.
And what was the, just in terms of the office atmosphere, because obviously you can't get Mad Men out of your
no,
the picture of the Don Drapers And I've seen, and of course, the pictures in your book of these guys with their pipes and stuff.
Yes.
It says a lot about that era.
Well, I always say, of course, the advertising guys were much better dressed than the journalists, and we didn't have martini trays in our office. And most of the guys kept the biscotch and bourbon in the bottom drawer. But yes, it was the 60s. It was an office wife sort of. We were the handmaidens to the writers. And there was a lot of sex in the office. Most of it, I have to say, was consensual. It was definitely the 60s, and we were pretty young. There were, however, instances where there was sexual harassment and people crossed the line, and there was a lot of behavior that would have been considered illegal today.
Well, it was considered illegal then, though, when you brought your lawsuit. It was, what, 4 years after the Civil Rights Act?
Right. The Civil Rights Act was 64, and we started organizing in 69 and brought the suit in 70. But Mad Men, remember, on television is the earliest 60s. So it's actually before the Civil Rights Act. And it was when, if you were a reporter, a woman who wanted to write and you came to Newsweek as your first job, they legally said to you, women don't write here. If you want to write, go someplace else.
Again, I'm speaking with Lynn Povich, who began her career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975, she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. And since leaving Newsweek, she has been editor-in-chief of Working Women magazine and the managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. And the women involved, along with yourself, are Ellen Goodman, Jane Bryant Quinn, Nora Ephron, Susan Brown Miller, some stellar names.
Well, what's interesting about those very successful women is they were hired at Newsweek after college in the early 60s. And when they realized that they weren't going to become writers, they actually left. They were the smart ones. We good girls stayed. So by 1970, they had gone. They were not part of our suit, but they had been there and seen the lay of the land and left.
But you had a trial run which went nowhere, and then things seems to work when you hired Eleanor Holmes Norton, who was the Human Rights Commissioner in New York, as your attorney.
At the time, Eleanor was the assistant legal director of the ACLU, and when we organized and realized we needed a lawyer to represent us and figure out exactly what we should do, we went to Eleanor, and she grabbed the magazine out of our hands and looked at the masthead and said, the fact that there are men from the very top category to the next to the last category, and there are only women in the bottom category, means that there's a pattern, and I will take your case.
And now, of course, she is the U.S. representative in the House of Representatives for the District of Columbia,
yes.
Albeit
the non-voting member, yes, of
exactly.
The House.
And if the Republicans have their way, she will continue to be the non-voting member, even though she does represent a congressional constituency. So what do you think, then, is the is the legacy here of what you've done? Because a lot of women who fought the good fight, and people like Gloria Steinem, when they're dealing with younger women, there is this sort of historical amnesia about how women got to where they are today, It's that old adage about unions. Yeah, well, you may not like unions, but they're the people who brought you the weekend. So, in a sense, you may like feminists, but they're the people who brought you the rights that you have.
Yes.
Yes,
I met some young women at Newsweek in 2010 who didn't know anything about our suit and discovered it and then started calling us, and we met together. And they became very interested. Two of them did not want to be called feminists at the time. And since discovering the suit, meeting us and talking about our history, which was very relevant to them, they were feeling some of the same things 40 years later that we had been, which was that they were being marginalized and they couldn't understand why young women were getting ahead faster. So by discovering the history, and I was a history major, so this makes me very happy, they actually became very interested in women's issues. They now call themselves feminists, and it has sort of reawakened this this concern. Of course, the political season has helped with the realization that what we took for granted as rights that we had won are now being threatened. But yes, I think that the young women had been turned off by feminism, mostly by the style of either what they thought it was or the people they thought represented it. And now you're finding, I think, a whole new interest and active participation of younger women.
But it's not as if your victory translated into a universal victory. One of the first things that President Obama did was the sign the Lilly Ledbetter Act, and that's still a battle before the courts.
Yes. I mean, it's. I always say, like the civil rights movement, the women's movement hasn't solved everything. There's some, you know, women have made enormous progress in all industries and certainly in the media. But, yes, there's some really tough problems. One is unfair pay, which this tried to reconcile. There are certainly very few women at the top. The glass ceiling is now at the sort of executive suite, where there continue to be very few women who run companies, including women in the media. There are serious work-family issues that I don't consider a women's issue. I think are a societal issue. But because women are mostly responsible for the care of their children and their parents, it's now become what is called the leaky pipeline. We thought if you just got women in the pipeline, they would succeed. What happens is many of them don't take bigger responsibilities or higher positions because they can't be both a boss and a good parent. And that's a problem for society, not a women's problem. It's a societal problem.
Well, I recently, Lynn Pavich, spoke with Hannah Rosen, who has a new book out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. And I think one of the main points that she makes is that just out of economic necessity, women are taking a huge part of the workplace and, more importantly, a huge part of the family income and a growing percentage of the family income. And indeed, there are an awful lot of women who hold up the entire family. And as she mentioned in her book, that having a man is just another mouth to feed for a lot of women. So there is, the economic realities of America has changed, but the rights of women have not kept up with the economic realities.
That's correct. And I mean, since Hannah wrote this book, I have to say that women have lost almost around 40% of the gains that they made, because, of course, the jobs that were lost were mostly in manufacturing and the kinds of jobs that men held. So it's not clear to me yet exactly where we're going to end up in terms of how men and women are working in the workforce. And I do think she's right that women have the ability to adapt to the new workforce and have the kinds of skills that are required in service economies, unlike what has been sort of considered male skills of manufacturing and stuff like that. But you have to look at those jobs. I mean, a lot of service jobs are healthcare jobs. They're not particularly high paying. And a lot of high paying jobs like tech jobs, which are growing, there are not that enough women in those jobs.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lynn Pavich, the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. So let's look at the landscape of reporters now, the ones that we see on television. And several of them are in the most high-profile positions, for example, 60 Minutes, which is still the big ratings news program that there is. You've got Lara Logan out there being a war correspondent. You had recently had Marie Colvin killed in Syria. Mm-hmm. I guess Christiane Amanpour created a kind of model, if you will, for the female war correspondent or foreign correspondent. So, how would you? Can you draw a line from what you all did at Newsweek in suing to where we are today?
Well, our suit was the first women in the media to sue, and after us, Time Inc. sued for Time Inc., Fortune, and Sports Illustrated. The New York Times sued. The Reader's Digest sued. NBC sued. So we kind of opened the doors for all of these lawsuits in the media, and there was enormous progress between 75 and 85 in all industries. Women just flooded into the workforce. And I think what you're seeing today is the beneficiaries of that, the fact that We had a woman on staff who was not sent to Vietnam. They would not send a woman to Vietnam, but she was later sent to Somalia. And women were not sent to cover wars. I mean, Gloria Emerson was very famously sent by the New York Times, but she was one of very few. I don't know about in Europe or the BBC, but in America, very few women covered that war. Now, as you're right, you turn on television, women are covering Iraq and they're covering Syria and they're Arab speakers and it's and they're covering the president. They're not just covering the first lady. So there has been enormous progress for women in the media. They're in senior management. They're just not at the top. I mean, the New York Times, for the first time last year, has a woman editor of the New York Times. Tina Brown is now the editor of Newsweek, editor-in-chief of Newsweek. But most of the network news stations don't have never had a woman head of it. The cable news stations don't have woman head of it. I mean, NPR has been better. It has in the past. But, you know, I think that that's an issue because you can get so far. You can be a reporter. You can be a star reporter. You can even be an anchor. We had, you know, two women anchors at the same time. But in terms of who's calling the shots, it's a different story.
But of course, in your story of how you and the women at Newsweek sued to get recognition and to break in to the glass ceiling and eventually move from being researchers and secretaries to becoming journalists, your boss was a woman, Kay Graham.
Kay Graham.
And she wasn't a sister, according to your book.
Catherine Graham, when we sued in 1970, had recently stepped in to run the company after her husband died in 1963. And she was, if you've read her marvelous autobiography, very insecure about her position there and the fact that she was now running this company. And she was quoted at the time as saying, "I think a man could be better in this job than I am." So when we sued, the editor of Newsweek, Osborne Elliott, called her to explain that the women at Newsweek had sued the magazine. And her famous response was, "Which side am I supposed to be on?" So on the one hand, she was a boss. She was the boss of the company. On the other hand, as one of the few women who actually owned and ran a media company, she herself was often the only woman in the room, discriminated against, not allowed in the gridiron club. So this torn, this sort of confusion in her mind, I think was very true for many women at the time of trying to make this transition. And she credits Gloria Steinem in her book as saying that it was thanks to Gloria that she finally began to understand what the women's movement was all about.
You mean Gloria sat down with her and explained it?
She met Gloria and asked Gloria to explain feminism to her. And Gloria said to me, it's quoted in the book as saying, you know, I sat down and I sort of did Feminism 101. And she invited me to go to a lunch with Stuart Alsop because she wanted me to explain to him what feminism was about. As she sat there herself listening to Gloria do it, as if she couldn't really do it herself.
Well, we're grateful to be able to have your book and for your sharing your experiences with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ian. It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Lynn Povich, who began a career at Newsweek as a secretary, and in 1975 she became the first woman senior editor in the magazine's history. Since leaving Newsweek, she's been editor-in-chief of Working Women magazine and managing editor, senior executive producer for MSNBC.com. She's the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.